All right, 1 o'clock having arrived, I'm going to call the January 19th, 2021 meeting of the Taxes Committee to order. The first order of business will be the roll call. I'll have Ms. Griska call the roll, and then if you would unmute yourself and please say present. Ms. Griska, please take the roll.
Marquardt.
Present.
Marquardt, present. Lislegard.
Present.
Lislegard, present. Davids.
Davids, present.
Davids, present. Abajay.
Abajay, present.
Abajay, present. Carlson.
Carlson, present.
Carlson, present. Detmer. Detmer. Garofalo.
Garofalo, present.
Garofalo, present. Gomez. Gomez. Her.
Present.
Her, present. Hertaus.
Hertaus, present.
Hertaus, present. Howard.
Howard, present.
Howard, present. McDonald. McDonald. Miller.
Present.
Miller, present. Moran. Moran. Mortensen.
Present.
Mortensen, present. Robbins.
Present.
Robbins, present. Sandell.
Present.
Sandell, present. Schultz.
Present.
Schultz, present. Stevenson.
Present.
Stevenson, present. Swadzinski.
Present.
Swadzinski, present. Joachim. Joachim. Joachim.
So
we do have a quorum.
Detmer is present.
All right, and Representative Detmer is present. Representative Joachim, I see her. Representative Joachim, can you hear us? Representative Joachim? I don't know if Representative Joachim is having problems, but I don't know how we count that. I see her, but she has an answer, so I don't know
present.
If she's... Okay, Representative
present.
Joachim's present. Representative
Sorry
Denver,
about
present.
That.
Representative Gomez.
I'm present, Mr. Chair. Thanks.
Okay, Gomez present.
I don't
McDonald.
Know if we have it.
Do we have McDonald? Or Moran?
Mr. Chair, did you call my name?
I did.
Yes, we did, Representative McDonald. So.
Present.
McDonald, present.
All right. Thank you, members. Thank you, Ms. Griska. So next order of business, we actually have January 13, 2021 minutes. So Representative Lislegard, have you thoroughly analyzed those minutes, and would you make a motion to approve?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I will.
Representative Lislegard moves approval to January 13th. 2021 Taxes Committee minutes. Any thoughts or questions on that before we take the vote? If not, this is a voice vote, so I would ask everyone to temporarily unmute themselves if you want to participate in the vote on these important minutes. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. The January 13th minutes are approved. So thank you. So we are also a couple, you should have, again, I want to refer you to the referral memo that you have. That's the way we're doing things as we refer bills to the division. And also at this time, I want to inform the public that if you want to, an easy way to see what materials we have that we're working with in the committee, just go to the Minnesota House of Representatives website, then go to committees, and then go to taxes. So Minnesota House of Representatives website, go to committees, and then the taxes, and you can get all the information is posted there. So members, we're going to continue with the overview of our taxes. And then when we're complete with that, we're going to move to the Department of Revenue and introduce our new Revenue Commissioner, Commissioner Doty. But at this point, I'm going to ask Ms. Templin. She will go to the corporate franchise tax. And we'll take questions after kind of each area. And so we actually have the corporate franchise tax and then excise taxes and then kind of some other miscellaneous ones. So we kind of maybe have about three areas left. But with that, Ms. Templin, if you would proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This, again, for the record, I'm Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. We covered last week income tax and sales tax, an overview of those two tax types for this presentation. And for today's agendas, we have three remaining major state tax areas that Representative Marcourt reviewed. We have excise taxes, other and other taxes, and corporate taxes. But before Mr. Klayman describes corporate taxes, I just want to give a brief overview of how much is collected from the corporate franchise tax and the incidence of the corporate franchise tax. Next slide, please. Oh, actually, let's stay on this slide. If we can go back, this is the slide that shows a 10-year history of the corporate franchise tax, starting with fiscal year 2012. You can see that revenues were in the neighborhood of about $900 million in nominal dollars and about $1 billion in adjusted dollars. And then projected for fiscal year 20, the projected collections for corporate tax are at about $1.5 billion. As you can see from this slide, that this is a very volatile tax. It is heavily influenced by economic or by the economy. Next slide, please. Thank you. And then the next two slides, really briefly, again, cover tax incidents. Again, this data comes from the Minnesota Department of Revenue's tax incidence study that will be updated in March of this year. And for this slide, this shows effective tax rates. And again, effective tax rates, or the effective tax rate, is the ratio of taxes paid relative to income. And you can see income is grouped into five quintiles, with the highest quintile starting at an income of $106,852,000, and the first quintile starting at $19,759 and under. And you can see from this slide the fifth quintile pays 0.3% in an effective tax rate. And the effective tax rate increases as your income decreases. So again, that would be a regressive tax type. And moving on to the next slide of who pays. This again is a calculation of taxes paid by household by quintile relative to total taxes. And when looking at the slide, all the percentages for each bar that you see to the right should add up to 100%. And you'll see that the fifth quintile bore the largest share of total corporate taxes at 46.4%. And the other four quintiles paid 54% of the total tax. And again, to sum it up, we show these tax incident slides just as a kind of a reminder that any changes to the rate structure of the tax or to a tax expenditure such as a credit or a subtraction does affect the tax incidence in some cases. Now I will turn it over to Mr. Klayman to go over corporate taxes in more detail, starting on slide 44.
Mr. Klayman.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Chris Klayman with the House Research Department. I'm going to speak to the corporate franchise tax, and then I'll be back to discuss a little bit more about some of the other taxes. Corporate franchise tax, one thing to keep in mind with this tax, it's a separate tax, of course, from the individual income tax. And it's a tax at the entity level, meaning that the actual corporate entity is taxed. For a business that's organized as a pass-through, that income is going to pass through to the individual owner, and that individual owner is going to be taxed on that business income through the individual income tax. The corporate franchise tax, this is mostly going to be the big publicly traded C corporations, not entirely, but that's largely what it's composed of. In this state also, we use single sales factor apportionment. One quick note I'd make on apportionment is that Minnesota, like most other states in the United States, we're a water's edge state, meaning that the income that's apportioned to Minnesota is based on the total domestic income of that corporation. And so, in other words, if there is income of that corporation that's foreign income, that's not going to be used as part of the income that is used to determine how much is apportioned to Minnesota. And so you can also see the rate up here. It's 9.8%, so somewhat similar to the top marginal rate we have under the individual income tax. Next slide. We do allow some tax credits under the corporate franchise tax. Some of them we also allow under the individual income tax. And then there's also a minimum fee that the state imposes in addition to the corporate franchise tax on all businesses, including pass-through businesses. The minimum fee is, best way to see that, I think, is it's like a minimum tax. But it's a minimum tax that's based on not just sales, but also payroll and property that's in Minnesota. And the only pass-through that doesn't apply to would be a one-member LLC. And so now I think I'm going to turn it over to one of my colleagues here. We can go to the next slide. Oh, I guess not. There's still one more here. Maybe a couple more. You can see, again, this is just to highlight the volatility in the corporate franchise tax. So the tax base is not necessarily very stable, and it'll go up and down based on the general business cycle. Next slide. And then moving on to excise taxes, I'll turn it over to my colleague, Ms. Hagler.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Klayman. Before we move to Ms. Hagler, are there any questions on this corporate franchise tax portion of the presentation? Let's see. I don't see any. So we will move on. Very good. Ms. Hagler.
Mr. Chair, actually, Ms. Templin is going to go over these first two slides, and then I'll pick up after that.
Yeah, very good. Ms. Templin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. I'll just quickly go over these tax incident slides that cover excise taxes. And excise taxes in this presentation aggregate three tax types, fuels, cigarette and tobacco, and liquor taxes. So you can see this first slide shows the effective tax rates for these taxes. An effective tax rate is, again, the ratio of taxes paid relative to household income. The effective tax rate for the first quintile is 3.5%, and the rate falls as income increases. Like sales taxes and corporate taxes, excise taxes would be defined by economists as being a regressive tax. And in fact, one of the taxes included in this, cigarette taxes, is one of the most regressive taxes. Next slide. And then finally, this slide again shows total taxes paid by quintile. And again, the fifth quintile for excise taxes, again, pays the largest share of the total taxes at 27.2%, with the other four quintiles paying about 73% of the tax. And with that, I will turn it over to Ms. Hagler. Thank you.
Very good. Ms. Hagler.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, I'm Alex Hagler with the House Research Department. So I'm just going to talk very briefly about some of the motor vehicle related taxes that exist here in Minnesota. I mentioned last week that these taxes are most usually the purview of the Transportation Committee and do end up in the Transportation Omnibus Bill rather than the tax bill sometimes. But just briefly, the motor fuels tax, or the gas tax, is imposed on motor fuel used by vehicles that run on public highways, and revenue that is generated by the gas tax is constitutionally dedicated to the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. And then the motor vehicle registration tax, which is also kind of known as the tabs that are annually renewed, is assessed at 1.25% of the vehicle's base value, and this tax just applies to the passenger vehicles. And here on the slides, you can see about how much was generated in fiscal 19. That was about $938 million for the gas tax and $804 million for the vehicle registration tax. Next slide. Moving to the cigarette and tobacco tax, the state sales tax rate of 6.875% doesn't apply to the sale of cigarettes and tobacco products. And instead, for cigarettes, there is just a flat $3.04 attached per pack. Plus, then there's an in-lieu sales tax of 63 cents added on top of that. And for tobacco products, the tax is 95% of the wholesale price. And tobacco products includes items like cigars, pipe tobacco, chewing tobacco, and vapor products. And there is an extra 50 cents per cigar charged for premium cigars. Next slide. So in fiscal 19, these taxes raised a little under $600 million in revenue, and a portion of that revenue is statutorily dedicated to the Department of Health for research purposes. There's also a 50 cent non-settlement cigarette fee that applies to cigarette packs. And what that generally means is that there are cigarettes produced by manufacturers other than those very large major companies that settled liability lawsuits back in the 90s or early 2000s. Next slide. The alcohol beverage excise tax is imposed on alcoholic beverages on a per unit of volume basis. The rates vary by type of beverage, and for beer and wine, the rates vary based on the strength of the alcohol percentage, and those rates are listed there on the slide. The tax is imposed on the manufacturer or the licensed distributor. And in fiscal 19, these taxes raised about $92.8 million. The alcohol beverage gross receipts tax is a rate of 2.5% that is added on top of the state sales tax when the liquor is purchased at a retail store or at a bar or restaurant. And sometimes you'll hear that referred to on and off sale. So this rate stacks right on top of the state sales tax and any local sales taxes that are imposed by the local jurisdictions. And this is something where the streamlined sales tax agreement requires that the state tax rate be uniform across all retail sales. So having a higher sales tax rate solely for alcoholic beverage would be in violation of the agreement. For example, if they were to say, okay, 9% sales tax on liquor only, that would be a violation of the agreement. So a gross receipts tax is a way to kind of get around that. And so the 2.5% tax in fiscal 19 raised about $98 million, and that was on top of what was previously discussed about the excise tax. So then I'll just quickly go into these two taxes that are kind of the more random taxes. The mortgage registry tax is imposed at a rate of 0.23% of the principal debt of a mortgage for real property within the state. The county retains a small portion of the proceeds. It's about 3% to cover administrative costs, but the rest is then submitted to the state for deposit in the general fund. In fiscal 19, this raised just over $117 million. And because this tax fluctuates with the real estate market, kind of like what Mr. Klayman was talking about with the corporate tax, collections from this tax vary from year to year and will fluctuate with the market and will make this tax a little bit less predictable than other taxes that we've discussed. Next slide. The deed transfer tax kind of goes hand in hand with the mortgage, but obviously not every single transfer property involves a mortgage. But so this tax is imposed at a rate of 0.33% of the consideration of the deed when the deed is transferred. This tax is imposed on the person transferring the property, but sometimes parties can individually contract otherwise for who actually is paying. And as with the mortgage registry tax, it's submitted to the county and then transferred to the state with the county retaining a small portion for administrative costs. And similar to the mortgage registry tax, this tax's collection trends with the real estate market. And in fiscal 19, it raised about $131 million. And then the last tax that I'll be talking about today is the lawful gambling taxes. And this is sometimes also called charitable gambling taxes. And there are two different types of taxes imposed on charitable organizations that hold these games. These taxes are imposed on the net receipts, which is the amount of money collected by the organization for putting on the games minus how much is paid out in prizes. So the first tax is the flat rate tax that applies to paper bingo, raffles, and paddle wheels, and that is just a flat 8.5%. The second tax is a combined net receipts tax, which is a tax that has multiple graduated rates, much like an income tax. And the tax starts at 9% and goes up incrementally until 36% at the very top. And those taxes are imposed on collections from pull tabs, electronic bingo, and tip boards. And together, these taxes raised $88.7 million in fiscal 19. And Mr. Chair, that concludes my portion for today.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Hagler. Questions? Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if I can ask, I missed my time when Mr. Klayman and Ms. Templin were talking about corporate tax. So I just wanted to go back to that if I could.
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, so Mr. Klayman was talking about how, you know, the corporate franchise tax is assessed only on C-Corps and then pass-through entities. That tax basically gets paid
on the proprietor's individual income taxes. And so I just was wondering, when you pulled up the, when you had the slide about the tax incidence of the corporate franchise tax, since that's assessed at an entity level, I'm just wondering how that analysis happened in terms of the breakdown of the relative burden in each of the income deciles that you talked about.
Mr. Clayman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gomez, I think I might hand this over to Ms. Templin to talk about the incidents slides. But the question is essentially, what's the incidence of the corporate franchise tax on income? And maybe the piece here, just to sort of set up what Ms. Templin might say about this, is that the latest tax incidence study actually stated that the burden of the corporate franchise tax falls mostly on consumers. And so that might be why that distribution is the way that it is. But I'll let Ms. Templin speak to the details of the incidence slide, if she's okay with that.
Ms. Templin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gomez, if I understand the question too, I think Mr. Clayman is also, I think what he's saying is on the right track too, that the corporate tax there, as you can see, the slide has the impact by households, and the department then shows the impact by households on the burden, that the final incidence of the tax, the final, you know, where the tax rests. And a lot of times, as Mr. Clayman suggested, that tax is shifted onto employees in the form of lower wages. And that is why it is often referred to as regressive tax. If that doesn't answer your question, I can check back with you and try to get you more detail.
Well, thank you, Ms. Templin. So Representative Gomez, in that incident report, they talk about on a corporate tax or a business tax, that those taxes are shifted. So the burden goes to consumers, or as Ms. Templin mentioned, to workers, or to the shareholders, the owners. And so that's why it tends to be a regressive tax. Did that answer your question, Representative Gomez?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that was what I was trying to get at, was sort of. Piece about, you know, we know that it ultimately gets passed on to consumers. So that I just was wondering what was included in that. So it's good to know that it's both, it's sort of like impacts on consumers and employees and potentially shareholders, I would assume, of the tax.
Yeah.
And then just quickly, if I could, I'm just wondering if you have an idea of the what are basically corporate taxes or business taxes that end up being paid by pass-through entities. Could you just tell me, like, kind of overall what the amount of revenue collected there is? Maybe that was in another slide.
Ms. Templin, do we have that data?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gold. Mr. Chair, Representative Gomez, at this point, I don't have that data on the amount paid by pass-throughs. I would have to go to the individual income tax for that, and could get back to you for that information.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll probably just follow up on a couple of those things with you. I appreciate the latitude.
Thank you. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Hagler, on your last slide on the gambling taxes, you showed a progressive tax that was from 9% to 36%. And I'm just curious, is that applied similarly like our graduated income tax? Are there tiers of those sales that different rates are applied? Once a entity gets to a certain tax level, the higher tax kicks in all the way up to maybe only the highest or the last part of sales are at a 36% rate. Could you just give a little bit more detail to that?
Ms. Hagler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hertaus, that is correct. It does act like the income tax where there are, I believe, four rates, and as the organization is collecting receipts, once it hits certain levels, another higher rate will kick in, and I don't recall that off the top of my head. But the the 36% rate is kind of like the top tier with income tax, where that 36% is only applied to a portion of the organization's receipts, whereas over the months that the that the receipts are building throughout the year, those lower rates will apply to that to the lower amount of receipts.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you. I was hoping that was the case and that it wasn't retroactive to the first dollar. So thank you for that explanation.
Thank you. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for either you, Mr. Chairman, or nonpartisan staff, we have received previous testimony that in many cases, charitable organizations are actually paying more in taxes than they are profiting from charitable gaming. So in other words, government is making more money off this than the nonprofit groups that are attempting to, that this is supposed to assist. Do we have any data to validate that allegation? Or is there a way that, is there any way we can see that from a factual standpoint? Because I've never actually seen that documented in an official document.
So before I call on Ms. Hagler, Representative Garofalo, I just talked with someone last week about that, and I just didn't see how that could be, but I asked the person to send me the information they had so I could take a look at it and pass it on. So I don't know if Ms. Hagler can add light to that, but I mean, could there be a situation where these charitable groups are actually paying more than they wind up with the profits at the end that they can, you know, send out to charity and help other organizations. Ms. Hagler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, I think I would have to take another look because I do also remember hearing testimony to that effect last year, and I would just need to take another look at what was discussed at the time. And I think this might also be a good question for the Gambling Control Board. But I think there also might be some interaction with the amount of money that aren't related to the prizes that the organizations cannot deduct from that net receipt amount. So I would just have to take another look at that. And as far as anything specific with specific numbers, I would also have to get back to you, Representative Garofalo, and the committee.
So thank you. I think it's something worth looking into and see just what that situation is. I'm hoping also I get some information from that charitable organization I mentioned. Anything else, Representative Garofalo?
No, Mr. Chairman, you hit the nail on the head. And maybe the advocates for the industry, maybe they can put together some documentation without revealing any private tax data. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. I don't see any other hands raised at this time. Representative Sandell, I know you had your hand raised for a bit. Are you still on the list?
Thank you. No, that's fine, Chair. Thank you.
Very good. All right. Thank you. And Representative Moran has joined us, so she is duly noted in the role also. Welcome. All right. We're going to move, I think, to the last area. Mr. Clayman.
So, Mr. Chair and members, I'll do the last few slides here. Minnesota Care Taxes is next. This is often sometimes also called the provider tax. It applies to more than just healthcare providers. Healthcare providers are actually specifically defined in this chapter, but the tax applies to providers, hospitals, surgical centers, and drug distributors. One quick note I would make on this, a couple quick notes. One is that the proceeds of this tax fund the Minnesota Care Program. So that's why this slide, of course, is called the Minnesota Care Tax. And the other item to note is that back in 2019, the tax was set to expire, I think, in 2020. And the 2019 legislature repealed the sunset on the Minnesota care tax, and but at the same time lowered the rate from 2% to 1.8%. So there was some recent legislation in this area. I think we can go to the next slide, too. The next slide, this is the insurance premium tax. Insurance companies, most of them are going to be exempt from the corporate franchise tax under the income tax chapter. And instead of paying the corporate franchise tax or a tax based on net income, insurance companies pay what's called the premium tax. And that's more of a gross receipts style tax. It's based on gross premiums. And so the rate is going to be lower than what it usually is for a tax on net income. So the basic tax rate here is 2%. There are some lower rates. This also applies to HMOs and other nonprofit health service plans. That's a 1% rate, of course, for those, slightly lower rate. Next slide. There's an interesting quirk in federal law that actually allows states to discriminate against interstate commerce when it comes to insurance companies and the taxes that they pay. And so Minnesota and other states are allowed to impose a retaliatory tax, meaning that certain out-of-state insurance companies will pay a higher rate than they otherwise would if the state where that insurance company is from has higher taxes or imposes other burdens on our state's insurance companies. So then the retaliatory tax applies. That's a real interesting feature of the insurance premium tax, because states are typically not allowed to discriminate against interstate commerce. It's heavily policed by the federal courts. And then there are some dedications on this tax too. Some of the taxes go to pay for Minnesota care, and then there's the fire pension aid as well. Next slide. The estate tax, the first thing to note here is that, you know, up until 2001, there was a federal tax credit for the state estate taxes paid. So essentially states could impose an estate tax and the federal government would pick it up. Since that ended, more and more states have repealed their estate taxes. Go to the next slide. There are only really a handful of states, not only, well, 33 states don't have any kind of an estate or an inheritance tax. And that, again, is in part the result of that change in federal taxation. The tax base for the estate tax, it's the value of the estate. And then there are some exemptions too. The big one is the basic exemption amount, and that's $3 million for 2020 and later. That over the years, that's gone up in a stepwise fashion. And we're now at the maximum that existed under previous law. This tax is also somewhat graduated. The rates go from 13 to 16% based on the value of the gross estate. One quick note on the gross estate, the Minnesota gross estate, it's basically the federal gross estate minus any non-Minnesota situs property. And if you're a resident decedent, your Minnesota situs property then includes your intangible property as well. So next slide. This is another volatile tax. You can see there's some old numbers, but it really depends on, you know, how big the estates are of a particular decedent from one year to the next. So it's somewhat volatile. Again, 33 states, they don't have an estate or an inheritance tax. Six states do have an inheritance tax, and one state has both, although there's a credit for the inheritance tax. That's Maryland under the estate tax. This is also a tax that's, again, most economists would say is progressive. It's got a pretty high positive suits index. And I don't know if there's another slide. Can we go to the next one, or is that? It looks like that's the last slide, Mr. Chair. And with that, I'll conclude this portion of the presentation, and we can certainly, you know, answer questions too.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Clayman. Any questions on that last portion? Representative Hertoff.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Clayman, on that last one on estate tax. I've seen and read some studies that show that the long-term effect of getting rid of the estate tax actually provides a net positive tax to the state of Minnesota, in that it greatly influences people not leaving the state or not domiciling somewhere else. That certainly is a pretty big incentive to leave Minnesota. It increasingly is apparent that you don't want to die in Minnesota. And that being the case, the argument has been made that the consumption ordinarily spent by leaving this money or capital domiciled in the state is a net positive. So have you seen any of that, or can you corroborate those studies that I'm referring to?
Mr. Clayman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertaus, I am aware of some of those arguments. There was I didn't call attention to it, but in that last slide, there was a bullet point that just raised that issue of, you know, to what extent does the estate tax, you know, impact a person's domicile decisions? You know, there's certainly, I have certainly seen arguments that it does have an effect on domicile. I've seen a couple arguments that say the other, you know, that go the other way. But it's certainly an issue that's debated within this particular tax area. But I don't have any, off the top of my head, I don't have any actual data that I can share right now. I might be able to pull some of that research together and send it to you if you'd like, though.
Very good. And Representative Hertaus, I think I've been informed that the Department of Revenue conducted a study on the estate tax in 2014. So that might have some information, too, we could look at also.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Clayman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think on this issue, it's certainly worthy to look at what the appropriate minimum state tax threshold might be if this state refuses, or if there's not the political will to eliminate the tax, maybe indexing the tax or raising the floor would increase the number of households that would maybe help stop some of the flight that we see leaving the state. I've compiled certain research and studies that suggest that we're losing about $1 billion a year of taxable gross income by redomiciling. And places like Florida just absolutely love Minnesota's taxing policies. So I've introduced already a state tax conformity bill, Mr. Chair, and it is a scalable type of thing. And so I think we should take a serious look at that this session. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Clayman, you suggested, you mentioned to Representative Hertaus.
Representative McDonald, you're cutting out on us.
Evidence that was substantial, Hertaus said, and you said, I think.
Representative McDonald, you're kind of cutting out, but I don't think we're going to get into a discussion on migration today. We will have another chance to talk about that. So have you got any kind of questions? I mean, I don't want to get into a debate on migration, and I would suggest that if you want to talk more about migration, just take a look at a recent House research study on migration that actually showed it's between the ages of 19 and 24 where we actually have the largest outgoing migration by far, like 10 times more than any other age group. So we can talk about that later, but Representative McDonald.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, actually I had a question that Mr. Clavin mentioned, but since we're cutting out, you don't want to get into the discussion, forego the question. Another day.
Very good. Thank you much. Thank you very much. Yeah, I don't know what was, at least I wasn't understanding what you were saying there, Representative McDonald, was cutting out. I apologize. Our final question, then we're going to move on. Representative Schultz.
Yeah, thank you, Chair McDonald. My question, my comment was going to be on migration, but one of the most recent studies I found shows that it's a very, very small effect that people with $1 million or more actually move because of, for tax reasons. It's like less than 0.3% of filers.
Representative Schultz and others, let's hold off for another day, but thank you very much. All right. Staff, thank you so much for the overview of the last couple of meetings. Appreciate your work and preparation on this. Thank you, very informative. We're now going to move to the next area, and that is a presentation from the Department of Revenue. And with that, I'd like to welcome Commissioner Doty and welcome you to the Taxes Committee. And of course, members, we work very, someone needs, Commissioner Doty, you might have to mute yourself here.
Oops.
All right, very good. I was getting, so welcome to the committee, the Taxes Committee. As you might imagine, members, we work very closely with the Department of Revenue, and they're here at our meetings. And so Commissioner Doty, welcome to your new position. Welcome to the committee, and we look forward to hearing from you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair Markport, members of the committee, again, thank you for having us here today. For the record, my name is Robert Doty, and I am the newly appointed commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I have three staff members here with me today to help me with the presentation. First is Assistant Commissioner Sarah Bronson. Sarah oversees individual income tax and withholding, property tax, tax operations, and the Special Taxes Division. Also, we have Assistant Commissioner Tracy Fishman. Tracy is responsible for tax policy and public engagement. And I will say that Tracy's official first day is actually tomorrow. And for the record, Tracy is filling my spot that I relinquished when I was appointed commissioner in November. And finally, we have our legislative director, Joanna Bayers. And she will be our main legislative contact for the department. And Joanna, along with Tracy, will be the individuals that you will most likely see here in committee. So with that, we are here today to give you an overview of the department and the work we do, including a preview of the upcoming filing season, an overview of free income tax filing. We will discuss how we protect taxpayer information, as well as our response to COVID-19. The Minnesota Department of Revenue provide services to a diverse set of customers, including individuals, businesses, and counties. We strive to meet our customers' needs through efficient and effective tax administration, providing quality customer service to Minnesota taxpayers and a commitment to continuous improvement. Our mission, as you can see, is working together to fund Minnesota's future. Our vision is everyone reports, pays, and receives the right amount, no more or no less. Our work is to implement the tax code consistently and transparently to ensure fairness. We strive to do our work with integrity, respect, excellence, and accountability. Now I'd like to share a brief video that gives more detail on the work we do at the Department of Revenue. And I will say that typically we extend an invitation to committee members to tour our agency, But unfortunately, given our current working environment, hopefully this virtual tour will suffice. The video, please.
At the Minnesota Department of Revenue, we collect and distribute tax dollars to local and state programs and help fund many of the resources provided by our state tax dollars. Our job is to help customers understand and meet their tax obligations under the Minnesota Tax Code through efficient and effective tax administration. Each year, we issue over 2.1 million income tax refunds and collect nearly $27 billion in tax revenue for the state. The revenue we collect supports Minnesota's vision to lead the country by example when it comes to supporting children and families, showing fiscal accountability, producing measurable results, embracing equity and inclusion, and educating Minnesota's next generation. We serve our customers with 1,400 employees across 19 unique divisions. Our employees work remotely and in offices located in St. Paul, Greater Minnesota, and key locations throughout the country. The COVID-19 pandemic has certainly changed how we do our work, but it has not changed our commitment to the people of Minnesota and to the administration of our state's tax laws. This video will explain how we support the state revenue system, serve our customers, keep data secure, enforce taxpayer compliance, and support legislative and executive policy decisions. How we support the state revenue system. We process tax returns for nearly 3 million individual income tax filers, including first-time filers, tax preparers and accountants, legislators, veterans, seniors, and farmers. But our work goes beyond income tax returns. We serve 850,000 property tax filers and 850 licensed property tax assessors in 87 counties, plus more than 430,000 business income tax filers from Fortune 100 companies to startups and garages, and over 345,000 businesses that collect, file, and pay sales tax each month. We administer over 30 different tax types like sales and use, corporation franchise, mineral, petroleum, and lawful gambling tax. And it takes all our employees, from those administering specific tax programs through taxpayer assistance and auditing tax data, to appeals and legal, communications, IT services, collections, criminal investigation, tax operations, and tax research to ensure the compliance of all Minnesota taxpayers located not just here in our great state, but across the country and around the world. How we serve our customers. Each of our customers has a unique circumstance, and we have a responsibility to help them all meet their obligations under Minnesota's tax laws. Because we serve a diverse group of customers, we need a variety of ways to deliver service. This ranges from advanced technical systems to in-person services, over the phone, and in writing. We continuously improve and update our information technology systems. Our website, which serves 2.8 million visitors each year, is the home for tax information, forms and instructions, and the latest tax credits and benefits. Our other online services include the Where's My Refund system that helps taxpayers who are expecting a refund follow their return through the review process, a sales tax calculator and interactive map that help businesses find the tax rate for any location in Minnesota, and e-services, a convenient, secure system that helps businesses file and pay online. We work to ensure Minnesotans know about free electronic filing options. We reach customers through nearly 200 private and public subscription email services. We also use social media to share tips on how taxpayers can file and pay, provide information on eligible tax credits, and promote our services and outreach activities. We help fund and promote volunteer income tax assistance, or VITA sites, in Minnesota. VITA is a free tax preparation service for taxpayers who are 60 or older, have a disability, speak limited or no English, or have an annual income of less than $55,000. Each year, our employees help over 1 million customers in person, over the phone, and through email, and open and sort over 2.5 million pieces of mail, and send over 3 million pieces of mail. Data security. We strive to be secure and efficient in how we operate by using the latest technology. Ensuring taxpayer information is safe and secure is one of our top priorities. Our staff, along with our partners at Minnesota IT Services, are dedicated to making sure Minnesota's tax technology systems are safe from hackers and online attacks. We process refunds as quickly as possible while also verifying the information to protect Minnesota from tax refund fraud. We protect taxpayer data by combining the use of industry and regulatory security controls and federal standards. Minnesotans trust us with some of their most protected information. We take that trust seriously. It is an enormous responsibility, but we pride ourselves on the systems and procedures in place to safeguard taxpayer information. Auditing, collecting, and criminal investigation. We make sure taxpayers file their return and pay their obligated taxes. The majority of Minnesota taxpayers comply with the state's tax laws voluntarily through education and information customers receive about their tax obligations. However, we are responsible for protecting the state's revenue through auditing, collecting, and criminal investigation. Through these efforts, we return more than $400 million to the state each year, supporting policy decisions. We provide the legislature and administration with revenue estimates of the fiscal impact of tax proposals and forecast revenues for several taxes as part of the state budget process. Various research reports and studies, including ongoing reports and one-time studies, are also produced. Our tax research division maintains tax simulation models and databases for state and local taxes and develops reports, studies, and statistics. Our appeals and legal services division interprets the tax laws for the department, handles taxpayer appeals, ensures the department follows the law, and helps draft and change tax laws. Appeals staff members work to resolve disputes with taxpayers and help the Attorney General's office with tax-related lawsuits. At the Department of Revenue, our vision is that everyone reports, pays, and receives the right amount, no more, no less. Let's work together to fund Minnesota's future.
Commissioner Doty, if I might, I was informed some were not able to see that video, or if they're on the phone, they might not have been able to hear it, but it sounds like if you have Zoom in the background that it wouldn't play. So if you could please send that video, could you please send that video link to members of the committee so we could look at that? And then also members will take questions at the end of the presentation. So thank you. Go, please proceed, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks so much for that. And Mr. Chair, I will make sure that we do get copies of the video to members of the committee. My apologies for how this is how that played out. So, but with that, I will turn the presentation over now to Assistant Commissioner Sarah Bronson, and she will start by giving an update on the upcoming filing season.
Ms. Bronson, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Sarah Bronson. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Department of Revenue. I oversee the individual income tax, property tax, special taxes, and tax operations divisions. The individual income tax filing season is what most people think of when they think of the Department of Revenue. The process of preparing for the filing season is generally consistent from year to year. At the department, we call this process annual changes. We begin when the legislative session ends in May by synthesizing law changes. We work to incorporate these changes into draft forms, and we publish the near final forms in August. Throughout this process, we engage and communicate with our stakeholders. These stakeholders include individuals, tax preparers, software vendors, and volunteers. We incorporate the feedback about our forms and instructions and make clarifications based on stakeholder questions. We publish the final forms in October. We know engaging our stakeholders improves the products and services offered by the Department of Revenue, and we work hard to build and strengthen these relationships. As soon as our near final forms are published in August, the department identifies the system requirements necessary to begin development. This is how we make the tax forms and software products communicate with our tax processing system. Gathering system requirements includes gathering information from over 20 software providers regarding over 50 software products, mapping how tax returns will feed into the department's systems, creating paths between a tax return and the taxpayer record, setting parameters for fraud detection, and creating ways to identify errors before refunds are issued. Developers and programmers at the department and at the software provider companies begin building the systems based on these requirements. They test and retest the systems internally to ensure everything works before moving on to the next phase. After the systems are tested internally, the department and the software providers test, adjust, and retest until we confirm that the software products are compatible with the department's systems. During this stage, we are not only testing the electronic filing systems, but also the paper filing systems. We test our data capture software and make sure that if someone files on paper, our systems know how to read the lines and pick up the information on that paper return. Finally, as we get close to the opening of the filing season, we start testing with the IRS to ensure our systems are compatible with the IRS system. All of this work is vital to ensure Minnesotans can file, pay, and receive their refunds in a timely manner. After all of this work, we are excited for the filing season to start. On Friday, the IRS announced the 2021 filing season will open on February 12th. We have also begun to assess how recent federal tax changes impact current Minnesota law to understand how tax forms, schedules, worksheets, and instructions will be impacted. Our job at the department is to make tax filing as easy as possible. The timing of the federal changes often leaves little time for the state to conform before the filing season begins. When Minnesota passes legislation to conform to federal changes during the filing season, the department must pause the season in order to implement changes and update tax forms. This can contribute to confusion, filing delays, and refund delays for Minnesotans. Software vendors also need to change their systems, and this typically requires a two-week period to implement and test these updates. During this update, the vendors do not accept returns. As outlined earlier, the department spends months ensuring the forms and vendors are prepared for the filing season, and changing forms in the middle of the season can create confusion and hardship for both preparers and taxpayers. As we do our work with software vendors to prepare for filing season, we are guided by our priorities around serving taxpayers and identifying solutions that support them. We are working to minimize the administrative impact to all of our customers, including taxpayers, tax professionals, and software providers. We are supporting voluntary compliance through forms and instructions that illustrate the changes required to calculate taxable income in a clear and transparent way. We are focused on protecting the integrity of the tax system and administer it in accordance with the laws currently in place. As we are talking about the upcoming filing season, we would like to highlight available free file options. Electronic filing is the easiest, most convenient way to file your tax return. Last year, nearly 90% of Minnesotans used electronic software to file their taxes. Many Minnesotans are eligible to electronically file their state tax return for free using tax preparation products from certified tax software providers. More than 800,000 Minnesotans are eligible for free e-filing, but do not take advantage of it. An individual may qualify for free electronic filing if their adjusted gross income is $72,000 or less. Filing electronically ensures that individuals will be using the most up-to-date forms, offer step-by-step instructions to guide taxpayers through the filing process, and eliminates the need to mail in a return. Taxpayers searching free file on our webpage will find a list of certified tax software providers and the corresponding qualifying information. One of the most important things we do at the Department of Revenue is data security. We take our responsibility of protecting taxpayer information very seriously. Our tax system works because Minnesotans trust their information is secure. While using technology is important for the convenience of our customers, it's also important for the security of their information. The Department of Revenue, in partnership with Minnesota IT Services, protect taxpayer data by blending the use of industry and regulatory security controls and standards. The Center for Internet Security, the SANS Institute, IRS Safeguards, and Minnesota IT Services Enterprise Security Office are the organizations and regulatory bodies that establish these security controls and standards. For example, we use security protocols for our e-services business accounts, much like those that are used to create an online account with a bank. This is a way to verify a taxpayer's identity so that we can provide secure and convenient ways for taxpayers to access their accounts and information. Our strong commitment and success in information and data security also protects our access to federal tax information, or FTI. Through our partnership with the IRS, we can access FTI, which is critical to efficiently administer the state tax system. Staff also receive annual security training and ongoing awareness campaigns, such as brown bag sessions, newsletters, and emails to keep security awareness top of mind. The technology tools we use are fundamental and essential, but appropriately trained and alert employees can make all of the difference. The department, along with the IRS, are warning of an increase in scams, including sending emails, text messages, and calling over the phone to fish for information, tricking taxpayers into giving criminals personal information needed to commit identity theft crimes, such as filing false tax returns. The Department of Revenue has measures in place to identify identity theft and ensure that refunds are going out to the proper taxpayer. The length of time to process a return can vary from year to year and from taxpayer to taxpayer. We take the time necessary to verify the information on every return to make sure the right refund goes to the right person. Our team knows that Minnesotans rely on their refunds at tax time, and we work hard to process the returns as quickly and accurately as possible. I will now turn it back over to Commissioner Doty to provide an update on the department's response to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Thank you, Ms. Bronson. Commissioner Doty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As COVID-19 became a worldwide pandemic, the Department of Revenue quickly got to work listening to our customers and providing them relief while also balancing the needs of state and local governments. The Department of Revenue provided taxpayer relief within a number of tax types. First of all, regarding individual income tax, we provided an individual income tax grace period for 2019. We allowed return payments and filing to be made on July 15th without penalty and interest to match the federal government guideline. Regarding business income tax, we allowed an automatic filing extension due. Regarding sales tax, we provided a grace period for businesses impacted by executive order closures, allowed payment relief for the February and March periods without penalty and interest, and provided that they paid by May 20th of last year. Regarding lawful gambling, we provided a tax grace period which allowed March, April, and May payment relief without penalty and interest if requested by the taxpayer, and payments were extended until June 22nd of last year. Regarding Minnesota care tax, we provided a grace period which allowed monthly and quarterly estimated payments originally due April 15th, a 60-day grace period. Monthly estimated payments due on May 15th received a 30-day grace period. And finally, regarding the occupation tax, we provided a grace period which allowed up to 60 days of payment relief without penalty and interest for the annual payment, which was due May 1st. These payments were then due July 1st. Another way we provided taxpayer relief was to allow the taxpayer additional options for how to calculate their 2020 estimated taxes. We provided three separate options. First, the taxpayer could use 90% of their estimated liability for 2020. Secondly, they could use 100% of their actual liability in 2019. And finally, they could also use 75% of their actual liability from 2018. Our overall message to taxpayers has and continues to be that if they underpaid or cannot pay by the due date, they may ask us to cancel or reduce penalties, additional tax charges, and interest for late filing or payment if they have a reasonable cause or are negatively affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. Our only request is that they wait for a bill from us to request relief. Instructions to request relief will be with the bill. As taxpayers request abatements, I want to share the circumstances that may support their request. Specifically, if the taxpayer cannot take care of their affairs for a time because they or a member of their family, of their immediate family, becomes seriously ill. The taxpayer was unable to pay their debts as they become due because they have significant loss of income. The taxpayer loses their job or their business has to close, which makes paying the tax an undue hardship. The taxpayer has a significant interruption of their business or employment and cannot manage it with insurance or other financial resources. The taxpayer has a history of filing and paying their taxes on time. And finally, the taxpayer makes any partial payments of tax or attempts to pay any underpayment on or near the due date. We have also made changes in liquor postings and tax and debt collections. First of all, regarding liquor postings, businesses required to suspend or reduce services under Executive Order 2004 will not be subject to liquor posting for taxes and returns due, originally due February 1st of last year, to 4 months after the executive order ends. Tax and debt collection. Taxpayers experiencing financial hardship due to COVID-19 and are concerned about paying tax debt or other agency debt can contact us to discuss available options. As we've said, the department is committed to working with our customers during what we realize is a very difficult time. I also want to just touch briefly on audits. Again, because we do understand these times that we're in right now, for taxpayers, and it may take additional time, to respond to requests for information. I would encourage you to reach out to the auditor that is assigned the case and work with them directly. Secure a statute of limitations extension if necessary, and develop a plan to complete the audit as quickly as possible. Our website has become the best way to communicate all of these COVID-19 related changes. This page, which is still online today, has all the most up-to-date information on actions the department has taken in response to the pandemic. It is clear that the pandemic affected all aspects of our work, and our VITA sites are no exception. Typically, we help fund and promote over 200 VITA, which stands for Volunteer Income Tax Assistance, sites in Minnesota. VITA is a service for taxpayers who are 60 years of older, have a disability, speak limited or no English, or have an annual income less than $55,000. The COVID-19 pandemic brought unique challenges to our VITA sites. In 2020, we shifted our in-person sites to virtual, so we could continue to serve low-income Minnesotans in a safe environment. Some of our VITA partners do expect to return to in-person services this filing season with proper precautions in place. And we are working with many of our partners to establish a virtual option for taxpayers. A list of in-person and virtual VITA sites will be on our website later this month once filing season is open and the sites have completed their certification. We learned a lot during the 2020 filing season, and we are confident we can meet any challenges the 2021 filing season may bring. Over the past—
Commissioner Doty, so we'd like to leave about 10, 15 minutes for questions, and you're certainly welcome back here at any time. So So probably a couple more minutes, and then we're going to open it up to questions, if that would be okay.
Okay, that's fine. So over the past year, the Department of Revenue has been involved with two significant taxpayer relief efforts, which is the distribution of funds to local governments and our administration of business relief payments to local businesses. As a result of the CARES Act, the state of Minnesota allocated $2.1 billion from the Federal Coronavirus Relief Fund, of which Hennepin and Ramsey counties received $317 million directly from the U.S. Treasury. The remaining $841 million was authorized through the Legislative Advisory Commission review process for distribution to counties, cities, and townships. And I can report that $838 million was paid to eligible jurisdictions, and 1,600 of the 1,800 eligible jurisdictions received an aid payment. And then lastly, regarding the business relief payments, in December, the legislature passed and Governor Walz signed a COVID-19 relief package. This package directed $88 million to the department to provide direct payments to businesses. And the categories that we are responsible for were restaurants, bars, gyms, bowling centers, and similar businesses. And a list of the eligibility requirements is on our website. And I can report that last Monday, we delivered or distributed 3,893 checks that totaled $67,320,000 to Minnesota businesses as part of our direct relief payment effort. And finally, I would just say that starting today, we will open an inquiry process for businesses who feel that they should have received a payment and did not. And that will be open through February 5th. So with that, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. And I appreciate the time and open for whatever questions that you have.
Commissioner Doty, thank you so much. And I really appreciate the Department of Revenue's response and working with taxpayers during the COVID-19, those who are seeing a burden and being able to work with them and make adjustments. So thank you so much for your presentation. And you're always welcome back, you and the department. So I appreciate that very much. And so at this time, I would like to open up for questions. And Representative Mortensen.
Thanks, Chair Marquardt. Commissioner Doty, as I'm sure you're well aware, the small business community has been devastated with the impact of COVID and the executive orders that have mandatorily shut them down. And I've been a part of businesses, in fact, I've owned a business where I've had to cut my overhead by 30%. And at the same time, when I had my company, I had to cut my own compensation by 80%. So I'm trying to catalog answers to this question as I'm talking to the heads of various departments. If your department was forced to cut 20% of your operating costs, where would you start?
Commissioner Doty.
Mr. Chair, committee, I guess I'm not 100% sure of the question you're actually asking me in this regard. If you could be
I
a
can
little
clarify.
Yeah, if you clarify, that'd be awesome.
Sure.
Representative Mortensen.
Sorry, thank you. When this virus hit, and more specifically when the governor took away so many options of companies to operate unexpectedly, I'm sure they weren't preparing for 20, 30, 50%, I've seen reports to 90% reductions in their revenue. So they didn't have the opportunity to plan for this. So I'm asking you, if you were on the spot and were forced to make a 20% reduction to your overhead, your expenses, your department, where would you start?
Commissioner Doty.
Mr. Chair, committee, I appreciate the spot that Minnesota small businesses across the state have found themselves in as a result of COVID and as a result of the closures. What I will say, it's hard for me to answer how what I would do necessarily in that particular situation. What I will say is that when the governor's budget is released by the end of this month, I'm assuming that again, small businesses and where they are will somehow be noted within the priorities of the governor. So I'm going to have to stick with that as a response to your question.
Representative Mortensen?
Well, that was absolutely zero answer. And these business owners they've been forced to make these decisions. I've had to make these decisions. So it's disappointing to hear that you would not be able to make these difficult decisions that thousands and thousands of small business owners have been forced to make.
Representative Joaquin.
Chair, actually, I have a question about the free filing. And I also want to thank Mr. Doty for all the work they do. I think people forget that with our state budget having 40% of our, over 40% of our state budget being from our, to fund our schools, our Department of Revenue helps us collect that money to do that. So I hope we're not thinking about a 30% cut for them to be able to do their job. So asking really quickly on the free filing, remind me again what the income level is for being able to utilize free electronic filing versus having to buy or purchase a program.
Commissioner Doty or Ms. Bronson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, sorry, I was looking for my mute button. It's $72,000 is the income limit. And some of the software programs do have other limitations, and that can be found on the Department of Revenue website, so taxpayers can use that to navigate their options for a free filing program.
Ms. Bronson, I remember hearing a $55,000 income limit. What was that referring to?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure. There is different limitations for the VITA sites. Okay. So that may actually be the limitation for a family to get free tax preparation at a VITA site.
Okay. So I think that might have been the VITA sites and not the e-filing. Yes, okay. So the e-filing free of charge is $72,000 or less, but the VITA sites were $55,000 or less income. All right, I see people shaking their heads firmly. So Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll double check on that and take it offline. I thought that was those numbers were reversed, that it was about $45,000 for somebody to file using the federal form. To file federally, you can do it without an income level, but state-wise, it was about $45,000, but we can take that conversation offline. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, other questions for the department? So Commissioner Doty, Ms. Bronson, you mentioned that the federal filing season begins February 12th. And I would presume that's when the state filing would begin also.
Mr. Chair, committee, you are correct. The state's filing and processing is mirrored directly with the federal IRS. And so those returns that the state processes have to first go through the IRS for processing. So we are pretty tied to that same date as an opening for filing this year.
Very good. Well, again, I want to thank the commissioner, Doty, Ms. Bronson, and other members of the Department of Revenue and the department that will be assisting us during this year. And again, I know we'll see you more as the year goes on. So again, thank you for your presentation today. So members, we do not meet tomorrow. We will meet on Thursday. And in living up to the tradition of recent chairs of the Taxes Committee, the first bill we hear in committee on Thursday will be a Representative Hertaus bill. So that will be first, and then there's a Representative Cleavorn bill. So members, With that, have a good rest of the day, and we'll see you back here on Thursday. Members, we are adjourned.